Josh Alcoholic. Howdy. I've been brought here to talk about politics and religion. My sobriety date is July 1st, 2003. And my sponsor is a guy named Bill Cleveland. And my home group is the Hermosa Beach Men Stag. And we meet on Monday nights in Hermosa Beach, California. And we have a saying there that it is where the men are men and the sheep are nervous. And we take, I swear it was just helping it over the fence. So I got a really dark black sense of humor, and I'm really going to try to keep it on volume 3, just because I'm honored to be here, really, and with so many wonderful speakers and pioneers and carriers of the torch in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm kind of part of the cleanup replacement crew that they're hoping is not going to screw everything up. I got sober. I'm going to talk all over the place. It's like a Quentin Tarantino movie. So if someone, I have no idea how much, I should go for like, what, 50 to 60 minutes or something, right? Something like that? Okay. Yeah, my dad was a drunk. Dishonorable discharge, well, borderline dishonorable discharge. You know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge from the Navy for selling cocaine on the aircraft carriers. Then went to med school and got kicked out for stealing morphine. Just the classic drunk in the book that builds up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls it the whole structure on his head with a senseless series of sprees. It's my father, and my mom. I'm going to talk a little bit about my childhood, only because not because it's why I'm an alcoholic, but I believe you know when you get sober at 18 years old, it's to moms, not to wives. you don't have this whole big life and career, and to dispel any misconceptions that we are no strangers to pain, young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and no strangers to complete alienation and isolation, because the disease of alcoholism is a slow self-amputation process. You know, it's like being an island and watching the water slowly rise year by year. Relationships, debris float out into the rest, into the abyss until you can't see it anymore, and you just slowly get used to it. You learn to live with less land, you know, and until you're in a closet and you don't have any more friends and you can't show up, you know, and you can't keep your word and you really, really want to and you don't know why. And you know, we get around, when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous young, you're a lunatic. You don't even know how to get a job or show up or shave or barely do anything, especially when you don't have a dad, you know. And the men in Alcoholics Anonymous kind of taught me how to live. They taught me how to do stuff that I had no idea how to do. So anyway, back to dad, the original, the OG. He got heavy-handed, you know, and my mom eventually left. And he was the guy who would help old women across the street and paint the widow's, you know, garage after the winter because her husband passed away, and would take care of people's stuff while they were out. I grew up in Washington State, not far from here. I was born in Tacoma and raised in Spanaway. My great-grandfather built his house in Tacoma by hand, and my dad lost it through drinking after we left. He drank it away, you know. They seized it, and everything good in our lives just kind of slowly evaporated as a result of his drinking. We left, and my mom remarried a man from Billings, Montana. Any Montanans in the house? Oh, yeah, all right, yeah, yeah. Great. Let's go field dress a deer. You know, I did that for the first time when I was 4, you know, with my cowboy stepdad. And he was a tech sergeant in the Air Force and a youth pastor at the church. And he could fix anything. And he had a mustache and a barrel chest. And he was handsome. And our front yard looked beautiful. It was like golf green, you know. And we had a view of Mount Rainier right in the backyard. Everything was just framing it. At night, when that door would shut and that deadbolt would slide, we'd just get the piss kicked out of us. My dad would show up drunk on several occasions, banging on that door trying to see his son because I wasn't allowed to see him. And my stepdad would pull out a .30-06. I mean, this guy was country. His middle name was Buster, you know. And he'd pull out a .30-06 and try to shoot my father. And my mom would have to grab me and get in front of the barrel and tell him not to do it. And I just kind of, that's the way I grew up. And the next morning we'd be at church praising Jesus, you know. And we'd have Bible study in the front room. And then you'd get, you know, you'd get pistol whipped if you touched his 9mm that was sitting. We had 150 loaded weapons in the house, you know. And I wasn't really allowed to have any friends or go anywhere. So I just camped and hunted and fished, you know, growing up and just learned. I remember naming the trees in my backyard. We lived on the edge of this forest and I would just talk to them. You know, I didn't really have any friends. I was a lonely kid. And my entire life, I did not feel like, I felt like that was a reason, a justification for mistreating people and that it was like a bad thing. I used it to get others to feel sorry for me, you know. And I am so grateful that I had the isolated childhood I did, because, I mean, I'm a writer, and I would not have grown the imagination that I grew had I all the regular childhood events happening, if I wasn't forced to go into my imagination. It would have never grown, you know. And one of the things I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that everything is eventually good. Everything is eventually good. It all leads to good. It all leads to evolution. Hardship is the road to progress, not ease and comfort. And eventually, the sense of ease and comfort that comes is when I accept that hardship is the road to progress and I can trudge one foot at a time through whatever adversity is currently at my doorstep. You know, this is a way of life that works in rough going. It is a philosophy based on giving. And so, anyway, lighten it up. To lighten it up, I know that, okay, when you're in the crowd right now and you're sitting there and you're looking up here, I don't know about you, but I have this muscle in my mind that divides me from my fellows constantly. It's called an ego. I'll get there later. I have this identity, right? And of course, I think it's my own identity. I don't ever want to give credit to my parentage, my religion, my contemporaries, my society, the books I read or I were forced to read, the people I grew up with or that were just in my proximity. I never want to give credit to any of that. I want to take all the credit for myself. So I got this identity I think I formed, you know, and that this identity I will defend to the death. And most of the time when I'm living in this identity, I see you and I think, oh, you're better than I am or you're worse than I am. And it is a constant division. There's rarely ever any equality when that knee-jerk reaction assesses the person in front of me. I'm either better than you or I'm worse than you. And that's what happens, right? Constantly. And I've got this dark, 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 dark past of mine. And what this ego does is it projects it into the future. I'm like a primate hurling my own feces forward, you know, knowing I will meet it again eventually. And so to dispel any of that or to give you some disillusionment, I know that I'm in a suit and I might look put together from the neck down and like a meme from the neck up. But, oh, he's definitely from L.A. Look at that stupid antenna on his head, you know? But I want all you to know I've been getting channels in Alaska this entire time while you've been stuck with basic cable. So, but this t-shirt, I had to speak, and I was wearing this long-sleeve shirt, right? And the AC broke. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm sweating like bad. I won't hit all of the things in my mind to finish that sentence with were very inappropriate for a microphone. So I was just sweating. And I took it to the dry cleaner, finally, you know, like 3 days before we're supposed to come, of course. And they didn't get it all out. So I look like I look good, but underneath I think I kind of smell like the Crusades. So if that makes you feel like we're on an equal playing field at all, that's the thing is people think that being a speaker, you get asked to speak or you get asked to share your experience, like we're elevated in some way, shape, or form. And you guys have been so wonderful to us here. You really take care of us. And it's very easy to believe it because of how well we're taken care of, that we are pretty awesome, you know? But the reality is that all of us are just kind of stumbling through the dark here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and some of us are further up along the cave, and we can tell you to duck in 5 feet, you know, or go to the left, or there's a hole there. But all the rest of us, in Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor, Bill Cleveland, his sponsor, Jay Stennett, they taught me that there is no hierarchy in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we are on an equal playing field at the end of the day. that it's one drunk talking to another drunk, that it's me sitting here hoping to God that all of you love me, first and foremost. And secondly, you know, the real truth, the real meat of it is that I hope that I can be authentic. I hope you guys can see a human up here that's just kind of gone through life and done the best he can. And that you can say, oh, you know, I want this too. I can have this too. If that's what that way of life looks like, if I can have levity, if I can laugh at my misfortunes, if I can keep on walking and progress and evolve as a human, I want that too. I haven't lost my sense of humor, you know, and I haven't lost my, I have such a black sense of humor. And if you want to know who I really am, just ask that beautiful redhead down there. I am a pain in the ass sometimes, you know, big time. And self-important and grandiose and immature, emotionally immature. And you hear in AA a lot, my sponsor taught me, you hear in AA that everyone is really, we're all very gifted people. We're probably top of our class if only we used our potential. We have a special kind of intelligence in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just, that was made up in AA. No one really believes that. I mean, there are no professionals to corroborate that theory, you know? And so when I got here, I used to think like, man, AA was just such a drag. You know, I'm 18 years old, and I walked into my first meeting, and it was at the Log Cabin in downtown Los Angeles, or Hollywood, West Hollywood, and there was just breast augmentations and white teeth and old men smoking cigars with gold earrings, and I'm sitting in there in combat boots, all black clothes, six chains hanging down to my ankles, upside down cross and pentagram carved into my arms, cigarette burns all up and down my forearms, like five holes in my face from the piercings that made me take out to go into a recovery house, looking at people like I wanted to eat them, you know? And I just did not feel like I fit in Alcoholics Anonymous at all, nor would I ever fit into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I had a lot of anger. I had a chip on my shoulders. I was violently anti-religious. And to those of you that grew up in a religious household that did not cling too closely to the tenets of their religion and experience pain at the tail end of that human error, you know, I understand. I feel your pain. I feel your anger against God. I feel your anger against religion. I had a lot of it. I remember when I was down and really getting into it and getting real weird, you know, and me and my friends are all drinking and we're driving around, we're playing in a black metal band, and we've got a big tank of gasoline looking for a church to burn down, you know. I remember just at the end of my drinking, starting my own religion. You know, I had I'd been asked to leave high school. I had been expelled from continuation school. I'd been expelled from independent studies in 11th grade. I have an 11th grade education. I got a GED when I went to get sober in my recovery house. It made me go back to adult school, you know, but because I was too smart for school anyway. They tested me as gifted as a child and tried to accelerate my classes, but I had a real bad problem with authority. And the worst thing they could have ever done was tell me I was smarter than the next kid sitting next to me. You know, because I stopped trying every day after that. I just would rest on my laurels since I was a kid. And so please do not compliment me. And I'm just joking. I really still want to sponsor people at the end of this, you know. You're right. I'm healed, you know. If you want, I'll be touching foreheads on the corner there after this. Bring me your pain. Bring me your wounded. I will heal you. But you get a lot of that in AA too, you know? We think we know something all of a sudden. I remember, I'll get to it. I'm going to go all over the place, so I'm going backwards. After one night in the dead of night, after getting the piss kicked out of me for the last time, I got knocked unconscious. My stepfather got incarcerated. I was 8 years old, 8.5 years old. My mom called all her friends. We packed up a U-Haul, and we drove down to San Diego in the dead of night. And I remember sleeping in the back of a trailer on a pickup truck in someone's front yard that my mom knew from high school for the first 3 months of being in San Diego. And then my father came back into my life. My mom worked her butt off as a single woman in San Diego, dropping me out from school every day, picking me up from school every day, feeling guilty, and me just playing it like a fiddle all the time, you know? Not only did you leave my dad, but you married a guy who beat me up every day, you know? Just driving the knife in. And getting whatever I wanted as a result of it, or whatever her wallet could afford, which wasn't much at that time, you know. But she worked her butt off. She got us a place. She got us a condo. And my dad came back into my life, and he was a good man who had alcoholism, like many of us. And most people sitting in here are good people, that have alcoholism. And we hear in AA, there's so many misconceptions, and I love to use my opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope to try to give a different opinion, because I've had a very different experience with the steps than I think a lot of people have. At the first, it was the same, you know? I found new knowledge, and I clung to that knowledge, and I armored myself in that knowledge, and I have a tested, almost scientific method that works and results in sobriety. What we have here is it's a scientific method. The scientific method just means the results can be quantified. They continue to happen. You do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and this is the result. If you can repeat the experiment, you know, that is the method. And we have a scientific method, obviously, for getting people sober here. You come here, you do something, you do it enough, you take these actions to the best of your ability, which is subjective, it will result in physical sobriety. And at that point, you can do with that what you want, because physical sobriety, Bubba, ain't enough. It's not enough, you know? Well, yeah, let's clap. We're humans. We clap. This is, something did ever happen to you where you're sitting there and you're talking to someone, you're like face to face, and you're like, what does a human being say next? Oh, yes, great, thank you. You know, you're like, I get weirded out sometimes just with communication because I'm a deep thinker, so I'm really going to try not to go down the rabbit hole today. I did a lot of hallucinogens in another life. But we have this idea that, you know, that self-knowledge can recreate itself in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it did it for me, and I'll get there in a second. I'm going to go back to my dad. I remember one time he took me and all my friends out to a movie, 15 kids. He didn't make hardly any money. He lived in a double wide. I have nothing against trailers. I know I'm in Oregon. I have nothing against them. And my dad lived in this trailer and on his ranch, and we had ponies and chickens and all that stuff, and he came down. He didn't make a lot of money, you know, and he took me and all my friends out to the movies. I don't even know how he got us there. And for the rest of that time in that complex, I had the coolest dad out of anyone, you know. He did that for me. And I started spending time up with him in Washington, and then we got in a fight. I've liked weird stuff. Ever since I was a kid, I've liked dark stuff. I like the stuff that goes bump in the night, you know. My first word was moon when I was a baby. And everything about the night has always just fascinated me. And I love horror movies ever since I was a kid. And they sent me to therapy at 4 years old for drawing pictures of demons and monsters and blood dripping out of moon's mouth and sea monsters ripping apart aircraft carriers in pre-K while everyone else is drawing pictures of their dog, you know. They're like, send him to therapy. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had 14 years of therapy under my belt. You know, I had three psychiatric evaluations. I had been on heavy, heavy antipsychotic, antidepressant, anti-anxiety, mood stabilizer, sleeping pills because of all the other stuff that was doing to me. I was on a slew of medications for over 10 years, you know. And I'm not here to give an opinion on medication in Alcoholics Anonymous because I am not a trained doctor. I'm here to share my experience with it. And if you're out there and you're not a trained doctor either and you got a guy who's real shifty and kind of out of his mind, and I know the newcomer can be super dramatic. I've got a feeling I need a pill, you know? But I caution you, there are some people out there who really need it. They really need it, and the world is a safer place because they have it. And sometimes when they feel guilt in Alcoholics Anonymous for taking it, and they stop taking it, they die. They kill themselves or they harm other people. So just, you know, let them feel safe here. Don't judge them over it. You know, everyone comes to God in their own time. Everyone has, it's a program of self-honesty. And some people are all right with different things than I am. And it's this just human dilemma that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I feel we have to guard ourselves from a gravitation toward tribalism. And tribalism exists when we have an us and a them. And we divide ourselves within Alcoholics Anonymous. And we try to conform, make this person conform to our idea, not because it necessarily is the right idea that will heal them, even though that may be true, but because we are reinforcing our own belief systems through them. If you believe as I believe, I'm okay. And we have to be careful that there's a space for people to come to God in their own fashion and to ask for help in their own fashion, you know, because everyone has their own pace. That doesn't mean I won't tell you you're not full of crap, you know? Oh, that sounds like a good idea. Sure, you know. Why don't you stick a dynamite up there and light it, too? But there's like a real levity, right? I mean, these spiritual teachers, these Indian, you know, gurus, there's a little thing, it's called upaya. And upaya is like a trick they use. They use a trick to bring you back into the moment. And a good sponsor always has lots of these tricks to help remind you of the truth. You know, and my trick that I've learned is levity, you know. You meet a newcomer and you say, you know, hey, no drinking tonight, and you can't stick any pills up your butt either, you know. And he walks away laughing. And it brings people out of themselves, you know. We have laughter here. We have laughter here. And so anyway, I should drink, right? So after... We got in a fight over those horror movies, and I got sent home, and I didn't talk to him for 3 months, and he died. I got a call. He was dead, and he was found on the side of the road, and he had been struck by a drunk driver. And poetic justice, you know? It was like the law of attraction. And my dad was a bad drunk, and I just kind of went off the rails. I was smoking cigarettes by then. I was 10 years old. Running away from home by the time I was 12, telling anyone in authority to go F themselves. And the fact that I follow rules today is still amazing to me, you know? And most of the time I don't still. I kind of bend them, you know? I'm working on it. But what I hate rules unless I've made them. If I've made the rules, then I'm up in your face enforcing all of them, you know what I mean? There's a reason we do it like this, you know? Here's my handbook. And you have to learn how to laugh at yourself, right? You have to learn how to laugh at how ridiculous we are. So after that all happened, by the time I was 12, my mom picked me up and she took me to a little hospital and told me my grandpa was having a heart attack. I'd been away from home for 3 days by that time. And we go to this tiny little hospital and she doesn't say a word to me except my grandpa's dying. And we walk in through this tiny waiting room and into the back down this hall. And I go to the right and there's hardly anyone in this place. And the door shuts and the deadbolt slides and I'm in a mental institution. And so I'm 12 years old, and I did 6 months in mental institutions when I was 12. And, you know, people, if you got upset, there was no padded cell, they throw you into the quiet room. The quiet room is made of cement, and everything is bolted down. And if you try to get angry and punch something, you break your hand. And if you have to go to the bathroom, they throw in a Tupperware. And so I went to the quiet room a few times. I had an anger problem. You know, some of us get here with an anger problem. What I came to find later in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I came here with a fear problem. I'm just so afraid, and I just want y'all to love me so much, you know, but I don't want to ask for it because somewhere long ago, men in my life and the whole male collective of our society taught me that it's weak to do that, to want to be loved and to want acceptance, that a true man is like the nomad, the cowboy, out riding on his own, you know? And everyone just kind of eventually falls in line with him or falls out of line with him, but he doesn't matter because he's true to himself. And like this whole idea of what it is to be a man still haunts me and affects me, and I make poor decisions as a result of not wanting to be vulnerable and get to the truth, which is that I just want y'all to love me, and I just want to love you back. I want to be vulnerable enough to just connect with you because my entire life I've been separated, right? Chuck C. talked about it, is that it's conscious separation from God. That's the dilemma. There are all problems are under one umbrella problem, and that is conscious separation from God. And all solutions are under one umbrella solution, which is conscious contact with God. So that's kind of crappy, huh? You thought it was your wallet or your job or your spouse or your, you know, and if there's any people in here, you're in the middle of a fight right now with your loved one or your spouse, or you guys had a fight in the hotel room, or you've got unresolved conflicts at work, and I'm just giving you permission to just let it go while you're here, to just let it go and to forgive. People are only capable of acting from their own level of consciousness. They're not capable of acting any one iota above it, and they all do the best they can. I do the best I can every time, even when I'm ugly. I'm doing the best I can. And if we just have some compassion for ourselves, we learn how to have compassion for other people. And at first, it was the opposite. At first, it was me have compassion for you as a newcomer. And at about 5 years sober, that stopped working. I came into a wall, and I'll tell you about that. So after this mental institution, I got transferred to a medium security residential treatment center. And while I was there, I learned all about drugs and alcohol. I learned all about like having someone on the outside waiting for you. And it was just, once you got out of there, it was just hitting the open road, you know, and it was just me and you, baby, against the world. And pull up two lawn chairs and watch it all burn. There's just so something so romantic and beautiful about that. Still to this day, just the destruction, you know. Just let's just meet each other like two planets and collapse, you know, and just total destruction. I love it. And I ended up finding out about that stuff, you know, and I got so depressed at one moment in there. I ended up stealing my shoes and getting my shoelaces, and I'd been falsely accused for someone, and all my thoughts and feelings were catching up with me. My dad was dead. I was beat as a kid. My mom abandoned me. I had no friends. I'd never known love. I'm stuck in this place. You know, it sounds good, right? It's a country song. And I ended up getting my shoelaces and putting them around my neck and tying them to the heavy hinges of the solid core door in my bathroom and pulling my ankles up to my waist at 12 years old. And I felt everything became pins and needles, and it became peaceful. It became like I was in an ocean of warm water, you know, and I could just feel 1,000 little pinpricks all over my body. And it didn't matter that my dad was dead or that my mom didn't love me or that no one loved me or that I wasn't enough. And I lost my nerve, you know, and or the knot broke. I can't rightly recall. But since I've been a coward my entire life, I'm imagining that that I lost my nerve. And I woke up on the floor with bruised knees and a welt around my neck. And as soon as I got out of that place, I drank. I drank. And the first time, and I had never felt that kind of peace in my life until I took my first drink, because the drink does something for me that it doesn't do for the average temperate drinker. It does something for me that's so elusive that I will risk everything for it. I will risk every relationship and every appointment, and I don't even know that's what I'm risking. I just want to feel together, you know? Because the nature of alcoholism, in Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of times it's been talked about so marvelously, and I always forget to say everything that I heard this weekend I loved, and I'm among people who I respect, and I respect your opinions, and it's been wonderful to hang out with everyone. You know, I'm just a small little elephant holding on to another elephant tail in this chain. And but anyway, I ended up risking everything for that drink the first day I had it in Andrew Gedman's garage. Vodka, 7-Up, water-spotted tumbler, sitting there. His father's gone. And I remember taking two big pulls of that first glass and him pouring me another one, looking at me like, that's disgusting, and taking another one, and I can't remember anything else from the rest of that day. It was significant. It was like the moment that I discovered I didn't have to be in fear my entire life, you know? I didn't have to not be able to talk to people or have to make fun of them or be mean or be cruel before they could get close enough to discover that I wasn't worth their time. And so I started to get loaded, and as much as I possibly could at 12, I did a variety of things, you know, but I loved malt liquor. I loved 211s, Steel Reserve. It'll get you there, you know. That's right. All my classy drinkers, yeah. Bedwetters, yeah, you know. If it was an Olympic sport, I would get the gold, you know. We should do that at roundups, you know, alcoholic games, you know. Measure the pancake of the bedwet, you know? Like, wow, there must have been at least 160 cc's of fluid in this dispersal. So I started drinking with weird people, man. Next thing, I'm a quarter Palestinian. My whole life I was having an identity crisis. I was a punk rocker. I was a rocker. Then I was a punk rocker again, making my own clothes, 13-inch Liberty spikes, you know, zippers that go to nowhere, you know, and like butt flaps with band tattoos or band symbols on it. And then I'm like, no, I got to go back to metal. I'm a metalhead. I've always been a metalhead. So I grow up my hair all long and black, and I'm, you know, playing in a black metal band. And And I still play music today because I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I thought, oh, I'll never do that crap anymore. You know, it was all ego. It was all image. And of course, now I'm in this fellowship of light, you know, the fellowship of the spirit. You know, I can't like horror movies. I can't like writing horror and science fiction because it's all dark. It's all weird. It's all twisted. I can't play in a black death metal band because that's weird. That's twisted. And I'm here to tell you that, yes, you can. If that's what you love, that's what you can do in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor, I'm so grateful he didn't tell me, you know what, it's either have a career or go to 14 meetings a week. He said, you can go to as many meetings as you want, you feel all right with for yourself and your program, and you can go to work and build a career. You can have a woman who is beautiful and also smart. You can play in a band and chase your dreams of writing, all at the same time, Josh, provided that you maintain a certain simple attitude. Provide, because I'll tell you what, a much more demonstrations of our principles lies ahead of us in our respective jobs, occupations, and affairs. That's where Alcoholics Anonymous shines. That's what I take out into the world. Come back to my bed at home right now and you'll find that it's made. Because gratitude's an action word. If I'm grateful for something, I take care of it. If I'm grateful for my sobriety, I take care of it. I'm willing to look like Caesar from Planet of the Apes in a suit. Because I'm grateful for my recovery, right? I don't want to do it. I'd much rather be up here in a loincloth with a dead rabbit holding it by the neck, you know? But, I hope, anyway, whatever. Whatever. In Alcoholics Anonymous, when I walked in, and by the time I was 18 and a half, when I was getting ready, I had an internet girlfriend before it was cool, you know? I had a brand new car in the driveway that I couldn't drive because I had agoraphobia and I couldn't go into crowds. I could not go to the DMV to get my license, you know? I had money in the bank from my father who'd passed away that I'd never worked an honest day for in my life. I did not have any character. I did not have any friends that wasn't centralized around getting drunk and getting loaded. You know, I did a lot of stuff while I was getting loaded. I even did meth once for 2 years. And, you know, you get weird on that. You get weird on that. You always know when you're hanging out with those types of people, you know, because they're talking about reptoids and the government, and then next thing you know, they're like, let's fix a car, you know? And there's always several things in the process of renovation, you know? I was just curious to see how this alarm clock worked, so I... a lot of springs in there, though. But... By the end of it, I thought I was the incarnation of a Viking warlord. I was drinking a lot, and I was all sorts of stuff. And not to mention, you guys have to consider that I was on a ton of heavy antipsychotic medication, and you're not supposed to drink or do anything on that stuff. So my brain chemistry was gone. And I was peeing in bottles in my room and putting them up on the windowsill, and sometimes I'd go back to grab one, the new fresh one, the Diet Dr. Pepper, but it was cold against that window and all the old bottles are cold too, and I must have drank my own piss more than Gandhi. And you know, and I'm sitting there studying demonology in my room because high school wasn't any good, so I'm sitting there studying demonology thinking I'm probably going to incant an ancient Solomonic presence to take me to some buried treasure somewhere on the earth, you know? And I thought I should have been born 1,000 years ago raiding the Carolingian Empire. You know, I should have been a Viking. I was displaced in time, and it was why I was having so much trouble. And... you know, because if you're on the long ship and you crap your pants, you know, Oleg's just like, I crapped mine yesterday, no problem, you know. And you just keep rowing. But out here in the world where people take showers, you know, and buy clothes, it's just weird. And and so I got sent to a recovery house, you know. I got sent to this place for 30 days, and I wrote a real long message to my internet girlfriend, you know. It's real romantic, like, when you look at the moon, know that I will be looking at it with you, you know. And I'd never mustered up the courage to go and meet her because I was too busy getting loaded all the time. And it was a safe relationship, you know. Loneliness had gotten that small that was a safe relationship for me. And I wasn't a partier, and I wasn't out there gaining the respect of my colleagues. It didn't look like that. It was real lonely. It was two to three steel reserves sitting on a coffee table with me watching Braveheart four times in a row, you know, crying when William Wallace gives his speech because I think, God, there's just no honor left in the world, you know, there's no valor. And meanwhile, and then I'd get up and pull the wad of cash I'd stolen from my mother to go buy more beer, you know. I mean, just in full flight from reality, where the alcoholic's life seems the only normal one. And I got sent to this place, and all of them were like Stepford wives. And that first night when I was in AA, they'd all taken me there. And I'm looking around, and I found this guy on break, and he's like, I said, how long you got? And he said, I got a week. And I said, God, this is crap, isn't it? He said, God, yeah, this is crap. AA sucks. I'm like, God, it sucks. He's like, these guys tell me what to do. I have to tell them when I go to the bathroom. I have to make my bed every morning. They tell me what time meals are. It's just trash. And we'd sit here and we talk, we'd just pass invective about Alcoholics Anonymous in our recovery houses for the entire break. And I'm like, man, screw AA. He's like, yeah, screw AA. And then he's like, all right, after the meeting, see you next week. I'm like, yeah, see you next week, you know? And that's how I started my journey in AA. I just thought everyone here was a bunch of emotional invalids that just coddled each other on their petty achievements in life, you know? Like, well, Ethel paid the gas on time, you know, this month. Well, fantastic. It's like, and Hugh over there got a driver's license. And I'm thinking, Hugh's 52, you know? What are we doing here? What is this? I watched everyone pass the baskets, and I had been to church, grown up in church, heavy church, and I knew what this was, and I saw God on the wall, and I knew what this was, and I said, don't you know, all these people just came from what I thought were cushioned lives, and here I am coming from a place, you know, I'm a quarter Palestinian. For a time, I thought I was a white supremacist. I was hanging out with Hammerskins, getting initiated into a chapter, not just not mentioning that my grandpa was born in Bethlehem and had a camel when he was little, you know? It's having an identity crisis all the time, just searching for new stuff. And so I'm in this place. I won't tell anyone anything about myself. And I just figured everyone in AA went home at night and plugged in like an iPod, you know, that no one here had any sort of independent thought process to rub between you two. You know, first things first, and live and let live. You know, the platitudes. I'm just like, are you kidding me right now? I don't want to hear this crap. This isn't going to solve my problem. You know, and you guys would do well to try to exercise some logic. You have a lot of illogical fallacies in your guys' arguments about why something works, why something doesn't. Don't you know how many books I've read? And they say, shut up, Josh. You know, you don't know anything about staying sober. If we want to know about ancient Sumer, we'll ask you, but we don't. But this is about learning how to do your laundry. It's been 90 days and there's cheese all over your dickies, you know? And so I'd sit in these places and I would just go on these diatribes like I'm now you guys are asking me to do it, you know? And I just took myself very seriously. And I remember in that house, I hated Christmas. I hated religion. I really hated religion. I hated Christianity. I hated monotheism with a passion. And it was a Christmas show, and they wanted me to be Santa Claus. And I said, are you kidding me? I said, no. They're like, well, it's either Santa Claus or hit the streets. And I was going to leave. I was going to leave that sober living because we defend our beliefs to the death. We will defend who we think we are to the death. And I had devoted a lot of time to being a bad person. I was mean to people when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was hard to let that go. I was bullied earlier in life, and I became a bully later in life. You know, it's the best way. If you can't beat them, join them. And I sat there, and I remember Mike Jolly, the guy who ran the New Life Recovery House that I went through, and he looked across the table at me, and he was just so, he was looking at me like I was a roach, like I was something he was studying in a petri dish. And he just shook his head, and he said, you know, you're going to end up just like your father. And I started to cry, and I couldn't stop crying, and I don't cry much. And I was the best damn Santa Claus they have ever seen. Since I went up there, I was chucking candy canes like Nolan Ryan across that, you know. And And I mean, and it's those little moments that we get in Alcoholics Anonymous where we make the decision to join the winning side, and we make the decision to let go of what we know and step into the mystery of what is unknowable, because it's an experience. You can't write it down. The reason you clap and laugh is because you've had experiences that mirror it. It's a heart knowledge. It's not an intellectual knowledge. And that's the language of the heart that everyone's always talking about. That's why we can help an alcoholic like no scientist or doctor or spouse or sibling or teacher or mentor can. Because we know the pit. We know what it's like to be there and watch everyone you love drift away. We know what it's like to disappoint yourself to the point where you no longer want to try or think you're even worthy of a second chance. You know, I just wanted to die when I got here. And I was more comfortable with just having all the rest of you die, you know, like everyone else could die. And I could be like that guy in the Twilight Zone who wakes up and he has all the books he could ever want to read, you know. But I don't need glasses for short term or for short distance. I do need glasses for long distance. I can't see any of you. It makes it easier to be honest. If I put on my glasses, I start to look like a Jewish banker. It's like, literally. And so, little moments like that started to happen to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went through that house, and when I had 1 year sober, I was up there in the front of the young people's meeting, and they were yelling out miracle. They were yelling out miracle because no one thought I was going to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, how could I? How could I? I didn't want what you had. I didn't like being honest. I thought honesty was just a joke. You know, it was more Christianity being reformed and shoved down my throat. You know, I don't need to be honest. I need to be true to myself. You know, the world is gray. It's not black and white. And just every justification you could imagine to hurt people and get away with it are the little tools I had in my sack in my mind. And at a year sober, that another crack happened. I just thought, holy crap, maybe I am a miracle. You know, maybe I am worth something. Maybe I can do this. And I've always been good at talking to people. Ever since I even hated AA, it was me. I hated all the committees and all the authority figures, all the people who the lawmakers. I hated all of them. But I would sit down with another little grub, you know, and us grubs would just talk. And I would be able to help guys into my recovery house. We'd stay up till 3 a.m, just, you know, jawing. And I appreciate that, and I've always had a gift for that. You know, my mom told me after I was sober for a while, she's like, I remember because one time, whatever, I kind of snapped my collarbone in three places trying to practice kung fu in the parking lot of a round table pizza completely drunk to impress a softball team of girls who later I found out were only 16, you know, but whatever. Because at the time I was studying kung fu with an ex-marine specialist who was a full-blown schizophrenic who I'd met in the mental institution that I got to revisit as an adult. And we were practicing kung fu in the park, you know, and my mom was just so proud. And every morning, Carlos in the big white van would pull up out front and give two beeps, and I'd be like, all right, Ma, see you later. I'm going to the mental institution for the day, you know. This 18-year-old just, gosh, that was my life. You know, and when I went through all those situations in that recovery house and I started to see these breaks, and I started to realize that there was a purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there was a purpose in helping other people. There was a purpose in having an answer to a problem that makes you feel like you're alone when the reality is that you're never alone. The old ideas that have been talked about this weekend, right? I've operated by these old ideas my entire life that I'm not enough. Right, and we even say it in AA, the myth here is that we're broken. And I'm here to tell you that you've never been broken and that you're not broken. That deep down is the fundamental idea of God, and that is perfection. That it's blocked out by everything else, that we have layers. That the process of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is not an addition process. It is a subtraction process. It takes away what blocks the essence that is in our center, that has always been there, that is indivisible. And that is perfect. And in the first step, I have power, right? I think I have power, and I think I can manage my life. Really, what it means is I think I can manage the results of my actions. That's what unmanageability starts to mean when we're in sobriety for a while, is that I'm going to do A, B, and C will result. That's not the case, you know? And so when I realize I don't have the power to solve my problem, and I don't, and I can't manage the results of my life and my actions, I give that up. That's in the first step. I can't do it. In the second step, I've been trying to solve my problem my whole life. I've been trying to figure out a way to arrange the ducks so that they behave. and they never behave. And I realize that I can't go into me, the source of the confusion, to find the solution to the confusion. And I have to give that up and say it must be outside of my mind. Okay. And in the third step, I realize that if that's the case and it must be outside of my mind, then this will and this life that I'm trying to control, again, like remember we learned in the first step that I can't manage the results anyway, I let go and let something greater than myself guide me. I start responding. I start opening my eyes to what's set around me and how my life unfolds and how when I take an action, if it gets really, 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 really difficult, maybe that's a sign, you know? Maybe I shouldn't, you know, continue on that path. And in the fourth step and in the fifth step, that whole process, what I have, Charlie Parker, I rewrite history. We rewrite our history in those steps. Because my entire life, I thought I had been abandoned, that I'd been mistreated, that my father was a drunk, you know. And when we, and I found out much later that when he got struck by that truck, he had a 0.36 alcohol level, you know, and he had cocaine in his system. And behind my back, there was a massive court case trying to get his pension removed and taken away because they were pretty convinced he'd committed suicide. And we were in a fight at that time, like I told you, and he had a card on the bucket seat of his truck. And it said, "Dear son," and it got shaky and it just kind of went off. And he was thinking about me before he died, and it was not enough to save his life. It was not enough to get him sober. So all you out there that you got kids, I love you, and I'm sure you love them, and they love you too, but it's just not enough. It's not enough to keep us sober. And in that fifth step, when I rewrite history, I see, oh my God, I had a part in everything, that the world and its people are often wrong, that some people are spiritually sick, that they deserve the same forgiveness I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I am awful rough on everyone else, and mostly it's because I am awful rough on myself all the time, all the time. There are pieces in us that we think are undeserving of love. All of it deserves love. I'll tell you a little trick. When I'm someone cuts me off on the road and I think and I see him speed and cut me off and boom and I start to get upset, I remind myself, oh, he's probably late for work. You know, he's not even doing it right. You're the best speeder and cutter offer that there is, Josh. You know, let this amateur have the floor for a second. You know, we all do it. And the same thing starts to happen in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. The literature's supposed to go on the left side of the coffee pot, you know. Everyone gets so intense about control in AA. And you just kind of let them. You just let them. You're like, oh, man, he's not even doing it right. If I was controlling this rodeo, it would just, it would look a lot different. And what starts to happen is that that love I've given to myself and made it okay for me to be who I am, all the sum of the parts, all of it, the ugly shit, sorry, stuff, that didn't happen. And, you know, all that stuff. What happens is I'm able to love you because the judgment I inflict on you are the judgments I hold against myself, and it's always been that way. It is easier to hate you than to see the same evil in my own heart. Carl Jung used to say that a doctor, in order to be effective, had to neither condone nor condemn the neuroses in his patients. He had to acknowledge the same darkness in his own heart as a human before he could meet it equably in the seat across from him. And so what we do is we put each other down because we're too unwilling to look at the stuff we can't stand in ourselves. And if you let it, that's what that fourth and that fifth and that sixth and that seventh is all about. And so in that sixth and that seventh step, what it gets to leave is all the stuff I've used to survive out there. Everything that I used to run game on all you people, right? Now it's a liability in this fellowship, which is like promoting honesty and things like community and hope and faith and trust and love and tolerance. And I have to let it go. And if I'm unwilling, don't worry, people will help me let it go. There are tons of situations that arise, right? If you've ever noticed, right at the right set of increments. And in the eighth and ninth step, all the reasons that I've had for hating myself or collapsing relationships or running away and avoiding conflicts or quitting jobs or keeping the control by just taking what I'm used to, which is crap, instead of risking something great, not knowing what the outcome's going to be. All the reasons I do that is because I still have all this baggage, all this stuff I don't want to deal with, all these voices in my head because I have not gone back and made restitution and made things right to the best of my ability. What that does is that builds self-esteem. That builds self-worth. That builds a knowledge in our hearts that we know we've done everything we can to correct it and that it's in God's hands. And that is a freedom. That is freedom to be able to look at all you and know that I am still, every speaker's a little full of crap. I'll just give you a little hint, you know. Everyone still stumbles. Everyone still gets selfish. Everyone, all of us, you know. And knowing that gives me freedom because I've done what I can to make it right. And in the 10th step, it's condensed. I continue to look for selfishness and dishonesty and fear and resentment. And when it crops up, I ask at once for it to be removed. Remind myself of that and turn my thoughts to other people because this is all about giving. And if you've ever wondered why people say the law of attraction, if you just think of physics, if you think that's too foo-foo-y for you, just think of physics. In space, a planet is crushed down to an orb because that is the most compact shape that mass can come into is a circle. It's the most compact. Gravity crushes things to be compact. And if there is a vacuum, matter will go into that vacuum to fill it up. When we give, more must flow in. If we empty ourselves out, more flows in. It's physics. It's the way the universe is constructed. And if you push out love, love flows in. And if you push out hate, hate flows in. And when I realize that, my God, there is I have this ability that I've been given to just pause when agitated or doubtful, to do my best to forgive quickly and to continue to try to love people and make them laugh, even if I can't make them love, make them laugh so they stop thinking about themselves for one goddamn minute, you know? And in the 11th step, I started to lose that identity I told you about. This person I am in AA now, Mr. Young AA. Mr. Young AA, I'm here to just liven you up and tell you how we really do it, you know? And I started to gain a space between my thoughts. I started to come to the conclusion that if I could watch my thoughts happen, then I might not be my thoughts. That if there's a thinking mind in there that's always thinking and addressing and categorizing and that's good, that's bad, that's ugly, that's pretty, you know, that maybe there's more. If there's someone observing the mind, then which one of them has more weight? Which one is real, right? And in the 12th step, I start to lose myself. I start to lose myself in you, which is where the healing takes place. The healing is rarely in the steps, fully, the work, I mean. Like, you got to do it. But that's not where the moments happen. That prepares you for the moments. The moments that happen are when you're sitting there on the phone, you finally had a bad day, and you call your sponsor, and you tell them what's really going on. And they're there to meet you with an open heart, and they listen, and they suggest, and they have a conversation, and then you realize that you're not alone, and that all of it has been a fabrication, and then you think about what happened that last, and boom, it hits. The real growth and movement that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is sometimes in the parking lot or in the car after the meeting or on the phone late at night. That's where the real love and the real transformation takes place. The steps sow the seeds that blossom in those moments. And so what I can say is that in Alcoholics Anonymous for the first 5 years, I should shut up real quick, right? Or it's 11:36. Ten or 15 more minutes? I've been doing pretty good so far, so this means I'm going to get to screw it up. You guys prepared? I've learned in AA the only time you really screw it up is when you try to make it all about you. And that's not what this is about. And the only time it starts to get hard to speak in front of this many people is when I think I'm separate from who you are. When I've got that division tool at work telling me that you were not the same, you know, that you won't get it, that I look like an idiot with this beard and man bun, that there is just no way you're going to relate. I'm lazy. I love long hair, and I hate wearing it down, and I'm lazy. It works. And you're like, I'm lazy. God, really. And in the first 5 years of my sobriety, I left that recovery house. I told them to go gave them the finger at about 20 and a half months sober because they wanted to keep me there even longer. And everyone graduated at 18 months, but they knew I was just so screwed, you know? They're like, get them out. Like, you got to stay for another month at least. I'm like, I'm not paying double rent. I'm out of here. Go screw yourself. You know, I racked up $2,500 of debt within the first week of being out of that house because I got a credit card for the first time. And that, they elected me treasurer at the meeting, so I decided to steal all the money, you know, piece by piece, $650 gone, cigars and adult entertainment for my friends, you know. And I'm thinking it's so much easier to spend AA's money than it is to spend everyone else's money, my own money, which there's hardly any. And then I was running around naked at young people's conventions. I was drinking energy drinks like they were some sort of healing elixir, you know. I was just being a young person in Alcoholics Anonymous, basically, you know. You're always trying to chase that drunken excitement and but get the benefits of a sober, collected spiritual life. And that didn't work for a while. I kind of went a little crazy in AA, and a man was there who was very prominent and very loud, and I asked him to sponsor me, you know, and he told me things like, you know, sit down, shut up, get in the car, we're going to a meeting in Burbank. And I think, Burbank? I live right next to Hermosa Beach. I don't want to go to Burbank. You know, we're going to Pasadena Young People's at 7:30, and that requires you to sit through traffic for 3 hours. Just to get there by 7:30. And I'd have to leave work early. And he'd say, if Bill wasn't out of his area, this never would have happened. And such crap. But, you know, I went. And what ended up happening is we started working the steps and I started getting some answers. The 12 traditions, we went through the service manual, the 12 concepts, which, like has already been discussed, it just makes you want to slam your face into a wall, you know, when you're reading it. It's like reading one of those legal contracts that ends up screwing you in the end, but you didn't want to finish it, you know? But it's full of a lot of great data and information, especially for the general certainty to why we do the things we do, the spirit of rotation, you know, the delegated authority, and why those things are important. But I didn't like it very much, and I started taking my sponsees. I got one, and then I got two, and I got three. I've been sponsoring people and lucky enough to sponsor people since I was able. And if you're in here tonight, you know, my sponsor taught me that you don't give it away to keep it. You give it away to get it in the first place. And if you're not giving it away, you don't have it yet. Sorry, that's not supposed to be mean. It's supposed to encourage you. If you haven't sponsored yet, you're not going to break them. Are you kidding? You know, they're stupid and crazy, and they're just already going to break themselves out there, you know? I'm say that as a qualified stupid and crazy person, by the way. That's not ivory tower mentality, I promise. But I just, you give, and something marvelous starts to occur. All the things that you've ever hated in your life materialize into an actual human being that asks you for help, you know? And slowly but surely, you start to grow through some of the judgments you hold on yourself and on others. And you start to build these fantastic relationships. You know, I just sponsoring a guy. He's about to do his first fifth step. He's been in and out for a while, you know. And he's like, you know, I can't start everything and I can't finish anything. And I just said, well, why don't we just start every day? And he'd never thought of it that way, you know. And he's just sitting there going crazy. The first meeting we're in there, he's sitting there, he's polishing some stone, right? And the next thing, he's braiding rope in these complex knots. He's a glass blower. He used to blow these big, exquisite bongs and sell them for like $3,000, you know? He's an artist, you know, he told me. So he's fixing a car the next week. He's doing all this stuff, and he's like, man, I don't know, I can't sit still, you know? I got to do this, or I got to do that. I'm like, well, put your phone away during the meeting, man. You can do it. Come on, let's do it. I'll do it with you. And he's like, man, I'm a craftsman. And I look at him, I said, Josh, you're just a tweaker. You know? And so now it's our joke. I'm always, how's your craftsmanship going today, you know? What are you crafting? And another guy that I sponsored and still sponsor, I just talked to him yesterday. You know, he was in school. He was in Ivy League College in Pennsylvania. and studying economics, bright outlook, you know, and he was so physically depressed, he was an old heroin addict, he ended up killing himself. You know, he tried killing himself. He didn't succeed, but he did. So this is the story. He takes all these pills, and then he comes to, and he's on fire. 8 hours later, he's completely red. His kidneys, his liver, everything feels like someone packed it with hot coals. He can barely catch breath. So he crawls. He runs a hot bath, just looks like a tomato, and grabs a kitchen knife, and he opens himself from his elbow to his wrist on both arms and both femoral arteries down his legs and gets into that hot water. And then, an hour later, he's in excruciating pain and he cannot die. And he flops out of the bathtub and crawls across the room and finally calls 911. And when the EMTs come in and they slide through the blood on the tiles, he just looks down and goes, last thing he remembers is the EMT looking down like someone just snotted on his face and going, Jesus Christ! So the difference between a normal person and an alcoholic after an event like that, I will now explain. A normal person would be like, I can't believe, they'd be stoic, they'd be there, they'd be trying to be collected, is there anything I can do for you? You know, and finally his sister calls me, I'm talking to his family long distance, and he's waking up, and he gives me a call, and the first thing I, as an alcoholic, say is, God, can't you do anything right? You know? And he laughs, you know. And for a moment, he's not thinking about himself. And we work through the steps, and he doesn't think he's smart enough. This guy had a perfect score on his SATs. Genius kid. And he doesn't think he's smart enough to do it. He doesn't think he can handle it. He doesn't, you know. And I just support him through it, man. No, you can do it. You can do this. And for the first 5 years when I was with that guy, my sobriety, the big sponsor that we were working the steps, reading the service manual, we were putting our thumbs on every sponsee. I would march sponsees to the liquor store when they didn't want to do their work and say, all right, I'm buying, you know. I don't want to drink. Curtis, you want to drink. Obviously you want to drink, you know, the way you're living your life. So I'm going to buy you booze. And I had to make amends to a ton of my sponsees for the way I used to sponsor. Because I was really working the steps while everyone else was just pussyfooting, you know? And that spiritual ego crushed me. That spiritual ego crushed me. And when I remember having 4 years sober and going to Bill's house in the middle of the night and crying. And this sponsor was always, you can do more. You can do better. Be here earlier. Get more sponsees. Do this. New life. Wake up earlier. Be a better man. Before that, high school. Go to class. Be smarter. Put your potential in full swing. You know, the doctors, the therapists, the psychiatrists, the big brothers, the reverends that my mom would have come by the house to talk to me. All these people are always telling me to be better than I was. All the time. And Bill Cleveland held me when I was crying, 4.5 years sober, because my very first AA girlfriend was drinking, and I was trying to go to Al-Anon, and I was getting guilt from my AA cohorts. And he held me, and he said, you're okay. You're one of the good guys, buddy. You're okay the way you are. And he fundamentally transformed me. He transformed me. Because my entire life in an AA, I thought I needed to be better always. I needed to be more. That AA was going to give me something I didn't already have. And I'm here to tell you that that's just not true. It only feels that way. And up to that 5 years sober, I was exerting myself. And after that 5 years sober, I started to have I went from having a personal authority and a sponsor to having an ultimate authority and a power greater than myself. I started to learn how to trust the intuitive feeling that happens inside of us when we know something's right or something's wrong. I started to trust the process and realize that, my God, all these steps that get taken piece by piece, when someone tells you to read a book, 3 different people in a day, that might be the universe telling you to read the damn book, you know? Like, and you start to see that I started to form a new relationship with God. God was so small. God, things like cancer and war didn't fit into my concept of God. Things like good people dying didn't fit into my concept of God, and God had to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until it was everything, everything. The collapse of stars and the birth of them. Everything. It's not moral. Just because something's cute and cuddly in nature, even though we're rooting for it on that special, doesn't mean it doesn't get snapped up into a crocodile's jaws. That is the world we live in, and we can't put morality onto this mechanism, but what we can do is listen to it. that there's a network that's working here, that all of us are in nervous system and constant communication with one another, that always, always, at the right time, the right person shows up to say the right thing, and that it all ends up working out. That is evidence of this manifestation that's a part of everything. We are fully connected at all times. We are not a part of or apart from. We are not separate. And I'll shut up by just saying this last thing about that guy and then something else. That while I was supporting him through all this stuff, he just didn't think he could go anymore, you know? And then he finally graduated. He was going to leave with like $200,000 worth of student loans because he's in Ivy League college going to be into economics, you know? And he stuck with it, you know? And he stuck with it. And he didn't give up. And I was there to encourage him instead of put my thumb on him like I used to when I was sponsoring the old way. I was there to be a voice of reason and of take it easy on yourself, buddy. You're going to do just fine, you know? Hang in there, you know? But you might not want to be a lying piece of crap while you're at it, too. You know, that might help. But there's a way to say things. There's a way when someone doesn't make it to the meeting, and my sponsees, I used to guilt them and send them 5 texts, and all the sponsees would send them a text, and they'd be sitting there just with a flu, hating their life and thinking they're going to drink, you know? Because you're guilting them. Guilt kills more alcoholics than the drink does. I think it leads more alcoholics out of Alcoholics Anonymous, guilting each other, you know? There's a difference. And it's an experiment. It's a variable. You just screw with it. Life is an experiment. It is the heuristic method. It is trial and error. They are the two most, they need to happen. You need to take the trials and the errors. The errors are corrective errors, you know? That's how we grow. The strikes of a sculptor's chisel are often violent. Entire pieces of us come flying off in these events that shape us. And again, if this is a network that's working together, if everything is connected and God is everything, then I have to trust those strikes and those movements and those rearrangements. And Robbie's got his PhD now. You know, he's in there. He's a teacher's aide. He's at the University of Illinois. And he has not given up, and he's got 6 years sober, and he's started meetings, and he sponsors people, you know, and that's the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a gift to be a part of someone when you sponsor them, and you don't even have to do anything. The power uses us like a conduit. The power is already everything anyway, so we don't need to take credit for crap, you know? It's just luck. And the last thing I'll say is this. Everything we have, it's not mine, it's Goldsmith. Everything we have, because I've been encouraged by all my elders in Alcoholics Anonymous to read outside literature, you know, and to grow and maintain the spiritual experience, to continue to seek. And it doesn't conflict with Alcoholics Anonymous. There, it does not conflict. Whatever your religious affiliation, whatever your ideas of God, none of that conflicts. If you're an atheist, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're allowed to be here. You know, you too. You're allowed to be here. And don't feel they're just trying to remember we're tribalists. We're just trying to reinforce our own belief systems upon you so we know that we're right also. You know, so just take it. Let them jab a little bit about God and God and God and God and have your own experience, you know. But everything we have, this the lights, the cell phones, the technology has been possible for millions of years. There are no new raw materials on earth. There are no new elements and there are no new physical laws. They've been here all along. But what was needed was a shift of consciousness to observe laws already in motion, to harness them so that we could make what we see before us. And if you allow it to, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will do the same thing for you. It will allow you to realize that God gave you everything you needed to be complete the day that you were born. Thank you.